I'm Gary Peck, your host on Memories and Music, presented Sunday at 1 p.m. by Inco Metals Company. This week my guest will be Gordon Calford, and we'll be talking about his experiences in the Sudbury District. Gordon Calford, a columnist for the Sudbury Star, also is the field representative for the United Senior Citizens of Ontario. Join Gordon Calford and myself Sunday at 1 o'clock when Inco Metals Company present Memories of Music on Stereo 92.7 CIGM FM.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Memories of Music on CIGM FM Stereo, brought to you every Sunday at this time by Inco Metals. I'm Doug McLaughlin. With an introduction to the guest on this afternoon's program, here's Gary Peck.
Gordon Calford is our guest today on Memories of Music. Mr. Calford was born on April the 26th, 1900, and on this program today we'll be sharing, Mr. Calford will be sharing with us a number of reminiscences about the Naunton area, Sudbury, and his work with Inco, a work that spanned, I believe, was approximately 30 years. So we'll turn the program first over to Doug McLaughlin, our music host. When we return, we'll commence our interview with Gordon Calford. Gordon Calford is our guest today on Memories and Music. Welcome to the program, Mr. Calford. Mr. Calford, could we begin the program with you sharing with the listening audience some biographical information? I mentioned at the onset, for example, that you were born 1900?
1900.
And where were you born?
In Calabogie, County of Renfrew.
Renfrew? Okay. East of here? Considerably east of here.
Well, yes. In fact, it's one of the old places, and I hear these people with the Ottawa Valley, and I think, well, I come right from the capital of the Ottawa Valley, which is Calabogie.
There are many people in Sudbury from the Ottawa Valley, and they're proud of it, aren't they?
It's true, there are, because I think Sudbury, as I mentioned in another conversation with you, Sudbury is a sort of a bottleneck through which practically all going west and stay remaining here, they came through Sudbury District, which includes Naunton, where I live now. And there's no question about it, we've had some pretty brilliant people from down there. I'm not classing myself as one of them, but...
But you're prepared to share that observation with us.
I certainly am, and...
Nothing wrong with that at all.
Sometimes I like to take a little credit. Not too much when I go back over my life and see that, of course, there is an old saying that if hindsight was as valuable as foresight, we'd all be millionaires.
That's
well,
right.
I'll go a little further. I'll say if I had only known that at the time of my developing, how gullible the public were, I'd have been a millionaire anyhow.
Interesting observation on society. What line of work was your father in?
My father he contracted rock work and right-of-way grading with the CPR. He always took his family with him. Now, we have been up around Nominating, up north of Montreal, and as far east as McAdams Junction in New Brunswick. And he has this line that runs from Rumford to Toronto, which at one time we called the Short Line, because before that you had to go around by North Bay to get to Toronto. Now then, that line, practically, I would say a good 50% of the rock cuts on that line were taken out by my dad.
By your father?
Yes.
What was his name?
David. David Calford.
And the entire family would travel with him?
There were just the mother and we two boys, Alan, who passed away here just a short time ago, and myself, and he took us with them.
Could be a rough lifestyle in some ways, but also very interesting, I suspect.
True, it would be interesting from many points of view. It was rough from many points of view, and yet at that time, a rough life was the norm.
The norm. You were accustomed to it. People were accustomed to it.
People, yes. Not only us, but people in general were accustomed to that sort of thing.
How many people would be working with your father on this? Was he a foreman for that kind of work?
Well, he was the contractor.
He
would
contractor.
Have a foreman under him.
And he would have how many people with him, approximately?
Oh, they varied anywhere from, I would say the least would be around 50 up to maybe 125. Now, on the jobs where there was 125, there'd be a lot of horses, because everything was done by manual labor at that time. It was horses.
Hard slugging and dangerous in some cases.
That's right. In order to get the rock out from the rock cut out to the fill, to the grade,
yes,
they used these, what they call stone boats. Mm-hmm. They made them right on the job. They cut the timber and they cut it into lengths. They bolted it together, put a ring on each end of it, and that was a stone boat. They ran them on what they call pole track. They would cut down the trees and peel them, and then lay them just the same as you would track, excepting that these stone boats ran on them. Mm-hmm. Then they would take and grease these pole tracks with the early primitive petroleum, and it stunk like nobody's business.
Would keep the skunks out of camp, probably.
I could tell you a little story about that.
I'm sure you could.
But they would load them with bars, roll them on, shovel them, whatever could be shoveled, but mostly there were big rocks that they would roll on, hook on the horse with a hook, and away they'd go, the team of horses, away they'd go out to the dump. On the way out, they would meet another one coming back, and he would haul his stone boat in. The other one would go out to the dump. At the dump, the men would roll them, bar the rocks off, and down onto the dump. So it was all, really, today they'd call it slave labor. But again, everyone was accustomed to it, and they didn't mind it too badly. In fact, a lot of them, Dad had men follow him around from one coast right up through here to, right up through as far as Tawanapate. That was the last, most westerly part where he had done any contracting.
Do you recall at all the types of wages that would have been paid at that time?
A dollar a day and board, which, and bunk. Incidentally, you that were getting the dollar a day in your board and your bunk, you built the bunkhouse yourself. And, of course, the board was supplied to you. That had to be, they toted them in with horses and sleighs or horses and wagons.
What would you have for dinner in those days?
Oh, for dinner they would have boiled potatoes. Do you mean a midday dinner? Or
yes, well, that was a heavy meal, was it not?
That was, believe me, they were all heavy.
They were all, yes, I suppose they were.
That's true, they were. Take, for instance, for breakfast they would sit in, most of them would have a great, immense bowl of porridge with canned milk, and then would come bacon and eggs, ham and eggs, and then after that, if there was any pies laying around, they would have pie.
For breakfast?
For breakfast.
What time was breakfast?
Well, breakfast would be...
Very early, I would
say. Yes, around 6:30, because they would have to be out on the job at 7:30 at the very latest, so that didn't give them much time to fool around.
Would they come into camp for lunch?
Yes.
Yes.
As a rule, they would come into camp for lunch because they would set up their... each of these rock cuts was quite an undertaking in itself. By that I mean you could set up a camp and you could be sure of at least maybe 1 month or 2 months' work in most of the rock cuts.
In that area.
Yes.
When they came back for lunch, what would be on the menu?
Oh, when they came back for lunch, there'd be soup. And it would be a good, thick, rich
homemade
soup.
Homemade soup that would really
made
stick.
Made with plenty of beef bones and that sort of thing. And then there would be meat, of course. A lot of the times, it had to be cured meat.
Yes, I would think so.
And as a consequence, salt pork took quite a precedence. And it was very good, too. I can remember when I used to think salt pork was a... side pork was about the best thing that you could get a hold of. But there would be meat, and as I say, soup. Then perhaps, depending on the cook, it'd be pies and maybe a pudding. And again, he'd make a sauce, his own sauce. They were pretty good, those fellas.
Lunch would be at 12?
It would be 12, yeah.
And then supper would, what time would the working day be over?
They'd work till 6.
And then come in for supper?
And then come in for supper. And supper would be a good deal after the fashion of the noon meal.
Mm-hmm.
Much the same.
And I doubt people had a weight problem, considering the amount of work they had to do.
No, there weren't very many, overhangs.
Soft people, no, I suppose not.
When they tightened their belt, well, they didn't have to tighten their belt, they wore suspenders. But when they pulled up their pants like that, well, they fitted into them nicely. Nope. They didn't, no overhang.
No problem at all. When did you first arrive in what we know as the Sudbury area? I believe Manetteville, you came there at a fairly early age.
Yes, Dad, I can't recall exactly where the last contract was before, but we had a house in Sturgeon Falls.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved up into there, and then he came in contact with an English family by the name of Weeks. They were a very, very clever family. In fact, some of them are still, Eddie, the oldest boy, is still living in Manetteville.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, through that contact, decided to come over to Manetteville. At that time, about the only way to get to Manetteville in the summertime was by the old Elgin L. Lewis boat from Sturgeon Falls. It went across to what they call the Landing.
Elgin L. Lewis?
Yeah, that was the boat.
That was the name of it?
Yeah. It was a little old flat bottom thing, and when it got rough on Nipissing, believe me, you had all the thrills of ocean travel. You didn't have to go out of the district.
People were very pleased when they sighted land, I'm sure, and reached it.
Well,
on certain occasions.
I can recall quite plainly, we'd load a wagon, and on that wagon they would put as much as they could in the way of baled hay, oats, and that sort of thing, for a starter.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would tether the horse close to the wagon,
mm-hmm.
and a cow maybe on the other side of the wagon.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the way they loaded their cargo.
Is that right? Now, was this around 1910?
1910.
What year did you come to Sudbury?
1914.
We're going to break now, turn the program over to our music host. When we return, we'll pick up that thread when you're in Sudbury. Location of Central Public, for the benefit of
right
some
across,
who may not recall.
Practically right across from the CPR station, the present CPR station, where the Sudbury Arena is now.
Where the arena is today. We're talking about an elementary school.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We were going into, at that time, what would now be called grade 8, but at that time we called it senior fourth or entrance class.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember a good many of us, particularly Bill Tate and myself, we went in bare feet. Not because we absolutely had to, but because we liked to.
It was comfortable.
It was comfortable, and most of the boys were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And
just before we start talking about Central Public, when we were off the air, you had, I thought, a very interesting story about the carrying of the shoes into the community. If you'd mind sharing that with us.
Well, you know, talking about going bare feet, it brings to mind the very true story. No doubt if there are some really old timers around, they'll remember.
Mm-hmm.
When people used to go to town, they would carry their shoes over their shoulders, or if they happened to take a Democrat or a wagon, they would put them in that. But anyway, when they got to the edge of town, they would sit down, put their shoes on, wear them around to wherever they were going for appearance's sake,
right,
and to save the
shoes.
Well. Then when they were through with their business and that, and they were going home, they would stop just on the outside edge of town, take their shoes off, and save them, and put them in either the wagon or over their shoulders.
Do you recall seeing that, or did your parents tell you that?
My parents actually practiced it.
Practiced it.
I couldn't say that I recall seeing it.
No.
No. I wouldn't want to say
that. That certainly tells you quite a bit about the pioneers, doesn't it?
But yes. They had problems then that they had to solve by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have the government or some agency
mm-hmm.
stepping in to say, well, we'll supply you with a pair of shoes. It was their own initiative. They had to do everything themselves.
People were very resourceful.
Oh, they were.
Now, you had an opportunity to go to school. Many of those people didn't.
That's right. But I might mention something here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not overly religious or anything,
mm-hmm.
but it seemed that at that time the people realized and recognized they were alone except for some superior intelligence to which they subscribed and to which they called God and to whom to them they were a very real thing. And they looked to them for help, and I believe they got that help. Now, maybe I'm over-gullible, I don't know.
What you're really saying is that was a very prevalent belief at that time.
That it was, yes.
That religion was an exceptionally important aspect of an individual's life.
One of the first things they would do in a new location would be to either arrange for a church service to be held by somebody,
yes,
or build a church. The next thing was a school.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
let's talk about Central Public. You must remember a number of the students.
The Central Public, Mr. McCartan was principal there at that time.
This is 1914
and
when you said it.
It brings to mind a good many names that bring a good many fond memories. There were, at that time, in what we call the Lake Section, there were the Skeens, the Horns, the Tates, Bill, Frank, and Arpit, Crawfords, Mel. Incidentally, Mel Crawford is up in Whitehorse now. The Cridermans, Jimmy is deceased. Tuttles, there was Charlie Tuttle and a couple of others. The Kirkwoods, Bob and Johnny. The Calfords, of course, me and Alan. And the Rosses, Happy Ross. His dad was city treasurer for a good many years. And the Smiths, Boyd Smith, he became quite known in air circles. And he had a couple of sisters, Dorothy and Marion. And the Meldrums, Jack, and the Boomers, the Stulls. The Stulls became quite prominent in our air transport. I know there are many others, but those particularly come to my mind and bring many a fond memory. And then from there, we went on into high school. We tried our entrance.
If I might just interject for a moment, discipline ever a problem in Central Public?
No.
And how was one disciplined?
Discipline didn't seem to be a problem.
No.
There were some who had to be
reminded,
brought up, yes, and checked up. To keep them within bounds, we had a few people that were inclined to become a little bit wild,
right?
And they had to be stopped because otherwise they'd have gone too far. Some of them did go too far,
but it wasn't a major problem.
No, it was not a major problem. I think the fact was that discipline in the home at that time was a lot different than it is now. There used to be an old saying about my dad, if you wanted your face lifted, just say no to him.
Mm-hmm. Now, from Central Public, you went to the high school?
From Central Public, we went to high school, into what we call first form at that time. Now it's grade 9.
Right.
And that brings to mind an awful lot of names that bring a great memory, very, very warm memories to me. There was Jimmy Mulligan. He became Father Mulligan in Coppercliff until he died, and a really fine man. There was Maxie Silverman, there was Les Clary, another fine man, and Jimmy Cooper, and his older brother. Then there were the Kilpatricks, Ken and Jack, and one, and the Wisemans, the Staffords, there were Jack and Joffrey, and they had the twin stores at one time. But anyway, that's another. Then from Coppercliff there was the Hambleys, the O'Connors, the Wrights, the Henrys again from Sudbury, Harry Claridge from Sudbury. The Rothschild, Sammy Rothschild. You know, I always admired Sammy. I think he was a really fine man. I might have been mistaken, but I don't think so.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly.
Then there were the Bissetts,
I was Gord very, being a very interesting individual.
Gord and I, when we meet, it's a talk fest. we both are fairly well gifted with wind.
Mm.
If anything, I think Gord's a little more gifted than I am. In other words, I think he's windier.
I'm sure he'll be pleased to hear that comment.
What do you mean impossible?
Your wife is saying impossible.
Then at that same time, those memories that come back to me at that time, they bring to mind different businesses that were in Sudbury.
Mm-hmm.
There was Scott's Men's Clothing. Now,
where are they located?
They were located on Durham Street,
mm-hmm.
just about across from the Bank of Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the Semi-Ready. You don't see or hear any of it now, I don't think. But I've still got some fairly good jackets that have the Semi-Ready label.
Mm-hmm.
That was Tom Ramsey. Now, there was another fine man. And then there was Irving's Drugs. Pete McLaughlin, he worked in Irving's Drugs for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think that's where he got his yen for the restaurant and coffee shop business.
Mm-hmm.
But
he's now living in Massey.
Him and Irene, his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Irene was they were very fine people, the kind of people you could admire.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, they bring back memories that are real memories, the kind you like to live with.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Wright's Butcher Shop, Young's Drugs, there was Aaron Silverman's, Meyer Silverman's, that was Maxie's dad.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Wilson and Greenwood. Oh, these things come back to me, you know, and I picture them.
Mm-hmm.
And they are really memories. And then the theaters, there was the old Grand Opera.
I think what we'll do, before we commence that section on entertainment, we'll take a break at this point and turn the program back to Doug McLaughlin. And when we come back, we'll talk about entertainment in Sunday.
Baggaging under George Bulmer. Not George Bulmer. Yes. Under George Bulmer. No, as a baggage when I went under George DeLongchamp. George DeLongchamp at that time looked after the baggage.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fairly loose setup right then.
Mm-hmm.
Developed very quickly, though. And I worked with Jim McDonald as a baggage master. And then I recall some like Joe Paul, Charlie Barbo, Jack Dominick,
mm-hmm.
Norm Walker, all fellows that bring memories
sure.
that are really worthwhile.
That CPR station when you were there was quite a credit to the community.
It was. Because
I've heard many older citizens make that comment.
It was kept in good repair. It was kept clean.
Excellent restaurant.
And an excellent restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
We used to eat there was to eat in one of the best places.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
you worked for Inco for 30-some years.
That's right.
Where did you work? In Coppercliff?
Well, I started out in Coppercliff, as I say. Cliff Stewart wanted me to go out to Froude, but I was too light. So in lieu of that, he got hold of Bill Armstrong, who was a metallurgist in Coppercliff. And, of course, Bill wanted, him and Cliff, I imagine, were good friends. And Bill wanted a man,
mm-hmm.
and Cliff wanted me to get in with Inco.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Coppercliff
mm-hmm.
in the metallurgical department, the sample house, which was labor. Everything was done by hand. You told
right.
them big boxes of samples on your shoulders. And anyway, I left there and I went into business for myself with the service station
mm-hmm.
because I had a yen for service station work.
Mm-hmm.
And I did well for the first year, but then after that I decided I was influenced by friends of ours
mm-hmm.
to take a couple of the family in with me so they would have jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, instead of being soft-hearted, I was soft-headed.
Mm-hmm.
That was a mistake. But anyway, I got out of that and I went back to Inco.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, I worked a couple of months at Gardner's.
Right.
And then I went back to Inco and I got on again.
Mm-hmm.
And this time I went out. It was quite humorous in a way when they sent me out to the converter building and they told me to see the shift boss. When I went out there, it was Frank Matt. Frank had too many men then and he was sending some men home. And he got pretty wild about them sending me out. And of course, I wasn't too cooperative. I said the man didn't tell me to go home. He told me to come out and go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that didn't sit very well with Frank. But in any case, Taylor was superintendent in there at the time. He came out and he says, "What's the matter, son?" So I said, "Well, I said this man tells me I should go home," and they said he gave me this slip and told me to come out and go to work. And I said, "I don't know what to do." Well, he said, "Just a minute, come on into the office." So he went into the office. He called up Wes McNeese in the Reverb,
mm-hmm.
and asked him if he could use an extra man. And Wes said, "Yes, send him over." So I took my lunch can and I went over, and I never went back to the converter building. And I stayed there from that time until I was pensioned in 19... Well, I went to... I worked in different parts
right.
of it. I was statistician, they called it.
When did you retire?
1968. I was 3 years over the age. But anyway, we don't need to mention that.
It's already been mentioned.
Yeah.
you enjoyed your experience, I would assume, with Inkle.
With Inkle, I think if a man is going to have to work for somebody, he couldn't get better than Inkle was in all the time that I worked there. There were dirty jobs. There were hard jobs. There were jobs we didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
But they were necessary to the operation.
Mm-hmm.
Smelting is a peculiar,
mm-hmm.
It's a unique industry, shall I say, because of it has problems that no other industry has. It has heat,
mm-hmm.
dust, and that sort of thing. And you're improvising a lot of the time,
right.
But Inkle, I couldn't work for a better company.
They treated you well.
They treated me absolutely well.
When you started, I believe it was in the early 30s, during the Depression, what was your salary?
Mm-hmm.
What would your salary be then?
The
hourly?
Was it 52 cents an hour? I think it was 52 cents an hour that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked 7 days a week.
7 days a week?
7 days a week. We worked through.
How many weeks holidays would you have?
Holidays?
Yes.
Paid holidays? I never heard of paid
no,
holidays.
No, not paid holidays. But if you wanted to take time off, you would only be allowed so much time.
Oh, yes. You would only be allowed not more than 2 weeks, if I recall
yeah.
properly.
Okay.
I wasn't looking for time off in those first
couple
of years.
No, that was during the Depression. You made an interesting observation. I don't want to pass over it quickly either. You hadn't heard of paid holidays. In other words, when you worked, you were paid for it. If you were sick, you lost it.
And if you were off for any other reason, you lost it.
You lost it.
That was my knowledge of it at that time.
Mm-hmm. And you were accustomed to that. People were accustomed
to
that.
That's right. But I am not going to say I enjoyed working every day at Inco. No, I didn't. There were lots of times.
But you stayed there for 30-some years. And you enjoyed that.
And if I go back and compare it with any other industry,
mm-hmm.
I find them right up on top. They're favorable to me anyway.
Good.
Now, I've had, not if I had taken my pension later,
mm-hmm.
it would have been much better.
Sure.
But I have a fair pension.
It's interesting. You're retired, officially
mm-hmm.
retired.
Yeah.
But you're really not retired. You're involved in a number of things. We're going to take a break right now. And then when we return, we're going to talk about you being a field representative of the United Senior Citizens of Ontario. I think that would be of interest to our listening audience.
I think that will cover pretty nearly the
okay.
work.
Good. Today on Memories and Music, our guest has been Gordon Calford. And, Gordon, you're quite involved, even though you're officially retired. I know you write a column for the Sudbury Star that appears Saturday evenings. In fact, that's how I first made contact with you. And you also happen to be field representative of the United Senior Citizens of Ontario. Tell us about that organization.
Organized the United Senior Citizens of Ontario. Now, it takes dedicated people for that because these people do not get salaries. They're
mm-hmm.
all
volunteer work.
Yeah. Now, one of the mainsprings in the beginning was our president, Jack Lorette.
Mm-hmm.
He's Vice President of the International or World Senior Citizens
What is the
Congress.
Purpose of the organization?
The purpose is to better the conditions of senior citizens in every way, hospitalization, money-wise, pension-wise,
right.
and to develop and bring out the talents that we know are not retired.
Exactly.
The body may retire, but the mind doesn't.
There are many, many untapped resources, in a sense, with senior citizens.
The potential is breathtaking.
Exactly. Are you finding that through your column you're able to generate interest in this idea?
That is true. It's amazing the number of people that will stop and say, "Oh, I read your column," and
you know
you're reaching these people because
you're meeting a need.
That's right. And the United Senior Citizens of Ontario, that is their prime objective, is to meet the needs, mm-hmm. not just the wants, but the needs, particularly of seniors.
Mm-hmm.
They take and fight the battle for that senior.
Okay. You just came back from a major congress or a meeting, I believe.
The International or World Congress of Senior Citizens Associations.
And held where?
It was held in Toronto.
Toronto, just recently?
Just in May, the 18th, 19th, and 20th.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed. It gave me a new concept of senior citizenship,
mm-hmm.
to see the caliber of people who were participating in this thing and the extent to which the need for this thing went.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I talked to people from Taiwan, I talked to people from South Africa, mm-hmm. I talked to people from Australia, I talked to people from the United States, all over mm-hmm. the United States, Mexico.
So it's very refreshing to find that the
object is, if you wanted to go into the theme this year was, the future is now, through the eyes of senior citizen.
Mm-hmm.
Their purposes, as they put it down, is to provide coordinates,
mm-hmm.
coordination on an international level, to safeguard the interests and the needs of the senior citizens of the world, not just of Sudbury or of Toronto.
But you're part of an international organization.
That's right.
We'll be hearing more about this through your column, I assume.
Oh, definitely.
I would imagine
definitely.
That forthcoming there will be an article on it. We're running out of tape. That always seems to happen when we have an interesting guest.
Because we both have too much to say. You notice I said both.
Well, yes, I know, and I'm not so sure I'd emphasize that. I've thoroughly enjoyed my interview with you today, and I'm sure our listening audience have as well. And what I promise is that we'll have to get together again, because I would like to talk about the Naughton community, for example. And I also know that you and I share a common interest, and that's an interest in museums and antiques. And perhaps we could, at a later date, talk about, the museum situation in the Sudbury District, and we'll pursue that theme anyhow. But on behalf of...
That would be something that would really be interesting, and I think would really be a tremendous payoff for the district and the city of Sudbury and the district in general.
All right. Definitely make a promise that we'll be together at a future date, and we'll pursue that theme. On behalf of Memories and Music, thank you very much for sharing with us many interesting anecdotes.
Well, it has given me a tremendous pleasure, and believe me, you feel a little bit warmer toward human nature.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, the best of success with your work in connection with United Senior Citizens of Ontario. It's a commendable organization.
It is commendable. I'm working hard. Because not for myself, I'm 81, I have no aspirations,
mm-hmm.
but for those coming after,
mm-hmm.
and there's, now when you realize that the United Senior Citizens of Ontario represent over a quarter of a million senior citizens in Ontario alone.
Good.
It means something.
It certainly does. Thank you very much.
And thank you for joining us this afternoon on Memories and Music from CIGM FM Stereo. Next week, our special guest will be well-known Sudburyan Wilf Sello. ¶¶